system that was primarily based on, you know, courts of law without larger regulatory state, you could light Lake Erie on fire. That's the reality. How long do you have to wait before the market corrects this through better property rights or something else? And another case that a lot of this is state of nature type Hobbesian situation, there are areas of the oceans right now that are covered with plastic bottles, right? Because the plastic bottles don't break down for 10,000 years or whatever godlong amount of time it is. Countries produce these. They dump them into the water. How is such a thing tackled? How do you solve this without some sort of regulation at some point? It is in my interest to produce these things, and there is no court that you can take me to make me stop, you know? So, and Bob, next
up. Yeah, I wanted to address your question about religion as a countervailing power to the centralized state. And the two examples that immediately spring to mind for me are the recent dust-off between the Catholic bishops over Obamacare. And I think it's really a fascinating case study in what de Tocqueville is talking about. You're probably aware that initially the Catholic bishops were very enthusiastic about Obamacare and a national health insurance policy. And now, gradually, as the implications of that policy become more and more evident, that is to say, the kinds of strings that are attached, the mandates that are going to be involved in relationship to issues about contraception, abortion, sterilization, we may get to euthanasia as well, and you sort of see them backing off, and I have the feeling that over the long term it's going to be a kind of a collision course, and the weight of this major institution. And I've also noticed it's very interesting that the way in which the Catholic bishops want to frame the issue is, we're not really talking about contraception here because that's such a complicated thing to talk about. We're talking about religious liberty. So they're starting to see themselves as the spokesman, the institutional spokesman for religious liberty against the long-term implications of Obamacare. And now it's, you can sort of see them being very uncertain about whether they're in favor of it or against it now that they see this as a potentially another one of these programs in which the potential for the expansion of the power of the state is potentially infinite. I mean, everything can be, when you think about it, put under preventive health care, dietary restriction, you know, to all the moral issues that the church often argues about. So that's one very, very, I think that's very Tocquevillian in the spirit. You know, you need these institutions as countervailing forces against the power of the centralized state. And it also raises the question as to whether or not the centralization, which we talked about before being driven by social justice, and that's the part the church seemed to approve of, but then we also see that the centralized state is also being driven by secularism too. And so they start to have mixed feelings about, and that's the same as the legal case, the Christian Legal Society at Hastings Law School. The second example is from Central Europe, of course, which was the battle against communism, hard despotism as opposed to soft despotism. And I think we saw communism unravel in Poland precisely because the church and the trade unions together remained as secondary institutions, and they were powerful enough to take on communism in Poland, and that was the beginning of the unraveling of essentially the whole, you know, Eastern Bloc, and eventually the communism in all of the countries. So I think both of those are important illustrations of the role of religion as a countervailing power, both the soft despotism, as Tocqueville talked about it, and hard despotism in the form of communist totalitarianism.
Okay, Elaine.
I think one of the reasons that the market has been slower than people might like in providing solutions to things like pollution is that, to a very alarming extent, to the degree that governments have got larger, they have actually crowded out market solutions. They've made it much harder, sometimes impossible, for markets to operate in ways that would then correct some of these problems. It's very difficult. These days, property rights are deemed to be a function of governmental decree and not of individual contract. So the kinds of moves one might look for in terms of improving situations like that are made much more difficult. But the further point is simply that Tocqueville is quite right to point out the interdependence of people and the difficulty of achieving anything of any particular scale as an individual without the cooperation of other people. But there's a really good illustration of this in a little work called I, Pencil by Herbert Reed. And this is a story which is told by a pencil, you know, a little writing implement. And he says, think of all the things that go into my construction and manufacture. There's the wood on the outside, of course, and there's the rubber on the eraser. This is quite an old story. There's the lead or the graphite that goes for the writing implement. You have to be able to fell the trees. You have to be able to move them to market. You have to have the machines to cut and manufacture this. This takes the cooperation of an immense number of people whose identities we don't know in all different countries, and he details where the rubber and the wood and everything else are coming from to make this simplest little item that everybody has in quantity, has no moving parts. This isn't high tech, this is very low tech, and yet it requires all of these things to come together. Isn't it miraculous? And there's no government actually appointing the creation and distribution of pencils. Think again, those of us who live in major cities, what if the government were responsible for making sure that there were groceries in the grocery stores? We'd be without, you know, our bread and our milk and everything else, most likely, because of the inefficiencies of those systems. Nevertheless, it's very rarely the case that one goes down to one's local supermarket and finds that basic ingredients are missing. Because somehow or other, the market, in its lack of design, has nevertheless managed to organize all of the necessary components to be there at the right time, in the right way, so that you can go up to the shelf and be sure of getting your container of milk or your tin of tuna fish or whatever it may be that you're seeking, or your roll of paper towels. So these things somehow or other manage to get organized through markets, although they require immense degrees of cooperation by all sorts of untold individuals in all different places. And yes, it's not an individual doing it on its own, but nor does it require coercive intervention by a government authority.
Kevin, and then Tiffany, and then Adam.
Just a couple things really quickly. As late as Dante, a perfectly fine word for justice is vendetta. Right? At least as late as Dante, right? So just to back up your point, that very deep in a certain kind of idiom, that's totally fine, right? I agree with Oakeshott and Hume that to really understand a tradition, you have to be a thoughtful participant in it, a discriminating master of the particular. Thus, I'm perfectly prepared to say I may not be an expert on totalitarianism, right? Having not engaged thoughtfully in the tradition of totalitarianism as a participant. But as far as I can understand, what people like Constant and Arendt are saying about totalitarianism is that the reason for these associations is that, yeah, they're buffers. I think Flagg said this, or someone else has said that they serve as ways so that individuals are not just seen as grains of sand, as Constant says, to be flattened out beneath the power of the state. Because, of course, it's true that associations can be pernicious. Of course, it's true that families can become problematic and dysfunctional. But as if governments cannot do this, right? So when they become pernicious and dysfunctional and morally intrusive, then who do you appeal to when you've voluntarily thrown all these other things in the trash can? And the material conditions limiting something like the federal government are much weaker than the material conditions limiting the tyranny of a father or something, right? So there's a kind of, I think, buffer effect that's very important for these groups. But I think also Pam and some others are quite right that these things shape the mind in a certain way. I mean, you know, Descartes publishes the Discourse on Method in 16-something, right? Not a historian. 1647 or something like that. In 1751, D'Alembert says, Descartes has produced he's created the greatest, most just and happy society that's ever been. Now, he didn't write any political tract. So you're saying, what is he talking about? So by the 1830s, Tocqueville says on the philosophic method of the Americans that they are thoroughly, if unreflectively, Cartesian, right? In other words, it has shaped them in somehow that they may not even recognize. And it has changed the habit, the character of the American people. right? To turn inward to themselves, to worry about producing effects, right? To judge all others by themselves. And this can be harmful if you're interested in public goods and things like that, right? So it matters if you have these associations, if you participate in them. I mean, it changes your character. This is, in a way, a facile point. And it's very old, Aristotle and all these other people would say, but it's not to be despised. I mean, I'll give you just one example. This is not as brutal as perhaps, killing someone, but it's not that far, right? So think about this, and I'm not talking about the moral rights or wrongs of this case. Just think about the difference in kind of what you might call philosophical stance. So one of my friends in graduate school was present when a couple was quarreling. They were separating. They were going to be divorced. My friend is friends with a young woman, but he has no claim in the situation. And the husband punched the woman. Two of her teeth fly out. So my friend rises like a storm, right? So Plato would say his thumos rises, okay? And if you've been brought up in a certain way, that behavior is not acceptable. And it's not because the police say it's not acceptable or the federal government. It's not acceptable because of how you've been habituated. So my friend, this guy was huge. My friend is just small. But you should see the other guy now. So my friend just flew in wrath and pummeled this guy. First shot's the best one, right? And all else fails, put thumbs in their eyes. Right? Important self-defense tip, right? Thumbs in their eyes. So
the learning never stops here.
That's right. So the point was, when my friend came back and told this story, it takes philosophers to kind of totally despise everyday common life, right? Many of the philosophy graduate students were appalled. So this was horrible. You had no right to do this. You should have called the police. You should have let this young woman just get beaten and appeal to the state, right? Now, I'm not saying which decision is right or wrong. I'm just saying you can see the differences in character there by someone who's been habituated in a kind of attitude or education or philosophy to push all problems onto other authorities and not handle their own business, right? And you can see it raised in my friend who was raised in Kenosha, Wisconsin with gangsters, right? Literally, right, with Italian gangsters. And he's like, this aggression will not stand. Right? And those matter. I think Tocqueville is saying those types of things matter. And because of the effects of democracy to turn people inward and make them isolated, it matters particularly in a democracy if you're raised in one way or the other. Anyway, that's too long. I'm sorry.
We're getting close to the time for questions, but Adam, you were next on the queue. I really hope that we could talk about the CLS versus Martinez case because it's... It was a real jaw-dropper for me. I had no idea that this had happened. Terrific. Go ahead.
Okay. So thanks. I'll preface this with using a couple of the words that a few other people have talked about. Like Elaine talked about, as the government gets bigger, it's crowding out the private associations that don't have the room to pursue their own ends because the government is pursuing its ends in their way. And I think it was Mike at the beginning of the session that said something about the overregulation of everything in the country in the sense that when the government gets to tell everyone what they have to do, and they're not even allowed to do it unless they do it the government's way, that's problematic. I'm building off of something you said. Another kind of interference problem is when the government says, you can have an association, but only if it's the kind of association that we like, because we're subsidizing your activity. And if you take our money and want to operate on our campus or be in our society, then you have to play by our rules. And that's the way the Christian Legal Society v. Martinez case kind of went. The idea is, if you want to be a student organization, then you have to be the kind of student organization that doesn't discriminate, and that sounds good until you realize that the whole idea of an association is to associate with like-minded individuals, and there are important reasons for that. One of which is that you don't want the people who have the opposite view hearing your strategy meetings and figuring out the political thing that you're going to do. So the campus Democrats have a genuine interest in not having the Republicans listening to their strategy sessions. But similarly, if you actually are trying to promote your own end, say as a Christian organization, maybe you have a reason to not have a Muslim leading Bible study. And if you're a Muslim, maybe you, you know, don't want someone who's not a Muslim leading your organization and trying to fulfill the group's mission. But what Hastings College of Law said is, well, actually, if you want to operate on campus and have a student mailbox and access to our email and maybe use the name of our university, UC Hastings, whatever, and be able to reserve rooms on campus and put up posters and even have access to student activity fund, which is a whole separate thing, but have all of those benefits of just existing on campus, then you've got to play by our rules, and our rules are non-discrimination. And non-discrimination means the Democrats have to let Republicans in, including leadership positions. The Christians have to let non-Christians in, including leadership positions. And that's the way we think a healthy organization is. So why does this matter if you're not a college student? In the city of Philadelphia, this CLS v. Martinez decision, which went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, basically on the subsidy argument, that if the government is giving you money, it can tell you what to do. The city of Philadelphia said to the Boy Scouts, well, we have a non-discrimination policy too, and since you discriminate on the basis of sexuality in addition to gender, we're going to evict you from the space that you've been in for 100 years because we were subsidizing your rent. And the lawyer for the city said, well, CLS v. Martinez, so if you want to exist and have equal rights in our society to have the subsidy that other nonprofits get, then you can't discriminate and you can't actually have the character that you want to have. And so this decision, which might seem very limited, kind of 5-4 decision on the very narrow grounds of what a law school can make its student organizations do, actually matters for the rest of us in this broader set of questions.
Okay, let's go to questions from the audience, from the students. And I'm going to try and shut down replies to like two, okay, so we don't wind up taking up all the time talking with each other and more spend more time answering there.
Hi, I'm Megan. I'm from Hamilton College. I'm wondering, at what point do you think it's appropriate for the government to intercede? I think you guys kind of touched on this, but to intercede in these make-weights. For example, there are some Orthodox religions in which women can't go out in public, or the rise of communism, and given that make-weights do shape public opinion, at what point do you draw the line between human rights and the good of the nation on one side and free association on the other?
What's interesting about what Mill says about the right to experiment with different kinds of lives, which I didn't quite say right, in his work on liberty, is related to his defense of Mormons against the Americans, who not only, does he say, not only did the Americans drive out the Mormons from their society, but then chased them down by going west and trying to stop them from having their experiment in the moral family religious life that they sincerely believed was actually the way to be human. And I doubt that Mill probably had a lot of patience for Mormon theology personally, but the idea is private associations, give them their chance, and if they turn out to be working and right, great, and if not, they have to be pretty evil towards their fellow members in the same way that individual citizens towards other citizens would have to act before the government's going to step in and stop them. And then the question of, you know, when does the human right come in and how do you define that? And, you know, again, equality isn't the only goal. And so what Catholics are told is that, well, you're discriminating on the basis of sex when you're not letting women become priests. And they say, but wait, we have a whole theology about why that's so important and why that is. And far be it for me to say, well, there's actually a human right for a woman to be a priest. I'm not Catholic. I don't even know how all that's supposed to turn out. But I do know that I'm not going to second guess the Catholics on that to the degree that I'm going to chase them down and drive them out.
Elaine, did you also want to comment?
A simple answer. Almost all anti-discrimination legislation, on whatever basis, is, I would suggest, a pernicious limitation of individual liberty. However much one might deplore the discrimination on irrelevant bases. And again, speaking of the CLS case, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And that is a legitimate consequence of the idea of private property and the rights attaching to it. And this is a very good reason for not having state funding of education or these other institutions. That then seems to give them a reasonable, at least a reasonable prima facie claim to control what goes on in what they're funding.
Yeah, go ahead, Ed.
Very quickly, I agree with that. And so the libertarians on college campuses say, why do we have mandatory student fees for student activities in the first place? Why do we have to start subsidizing groups in the first place? And then once you do, you say, all right, well, once now that we do it, we have to treat groups equally. And that's so it's that second question that's the problem.
Doug. Marta.
Marta Johnson from Hamilton College. So we talked, or I guess you guys, talked about the importance of these institutions of private association for kind of counterbalancing the government expansion and government objectives, which, you know, seems to imply to me at least that they're not in any way part of the government. If they want to affect change or legislation, you know, we talked about the Sierra Club trying to get people to ask their representatives to change something. But it seems like, you know, nowadays it's not necessarily like that. You know, the Sierra Club has lobbyists who will actually write legislation. And one, you know, private association that we didn't really talk about was corporations. And, you know, they obviously do a lot of lobbying. And they'll sometimes, you know, write the laws themselves. So I guess this to me seems like maybe they're going inside of the government in a way that they didn't before. So how does this change the sort of fundamental balance and relationship between private associations and the government, and I guess what does it mean in terms of limited government?
Go ahead, Jim, and then Mike.
I think, Marta, there are two kinds of private associations, one of which is to effect mutually beneficial exchanges among the members, such as the Don Corleone and the Sopranos and so forth, resolving disputes and establishing property rights. Another example is the miners' associations, which established a means of creating claims, property claims on mineral rights, and adjudicating disputes about this, which they did nonviolently through shunning. The Sierra Club and other private associations exist, I think, to first persuade and then through the government compel other persons, non-members of the association, to do things that they would not otherwise do. So I think it's important to make that distinction. I think beyond that, I've lost your question.
Hi, Marta. You may have reason to be depressed. So Lynn Ostrom won the Nobel Prize in Economics 2 years, maybe 3 years ago now, for demonstrating how voluntary associations have come together to solve all kinds of pollution, externality, public goods problems. And folks like me jump all over that and say, it's great, it's possible, we'll solve global warming voluntarily. And but you know, if you look at the data, every single of the hundreds of cases she shows is from a place that's very rural, 95% agricultural. There's never, in my view, been a modern industrial economy where you've actually seen that kind of a flourishing in that magnitude work. And so when Tocqueville was writing, and I'll give you quick, you know, 80% of the American population was in farming, even in 1900 when the mutual aid societies grew, 40%, and now it's 2%. And just for quick data, you know, if you read David Beto's great book, From Mutual Aid to the Welfare State, he tracks the history of these institutions in America, and he basically about one in three Americans in 1900 were in mutual aid societies, in cities as well, and we don't have time.
Go ahead.
Let me briefly answer the question, as is my wont, historically, that and maybe the Sierra Club isn't the best example here, but part of the transformation of liberalism beginning at the end of the 19th and into the 20th century, has encouraged the formation of just these kinds of groups, and you know this from the progressives, but it, you know, it increased during the New Deal and then into the Great Society, the formation of just these kinds of groups for the express purpose of voicing their grievances and petitioning the government for redress. So the whole purpose of organization was to get the ear of the government, and those groups that didn't have that kind of organization were routinely ignored. So there was no real call for common sense kind of justice. It was who has the power to shape and petition the government to redress their particular grievances. So I think that's how and why such groups developed.
Hi, Peter Harrison, Hamilton College. I was wondering if you guys think the lobbying firms like Greenpeace and Sierra Club are a bad thing, and if they add to centralized government, and like who else they appeal to.
Go ahead, Mike. And then Elaine.
They're a bad thing if you worry about rent-seeking. I mean, in some sense, if you care about the ultimate goal of getting a cleaner river, the more resources you spend fighting over that fixed resources is wasteful. So if there were a way to make more competitive forces get you there, fine. In terms of their constituency, remember, the thing that I found virtuous about the mutual aid societies is that they were mutual in the sense that people were from similar backgrounds, and so you had a lot more ability at the time to tell your fellow craftsmen, get in gear. So they were from similar-minded people. The Sierra Club and Greenpeace comes from a group of very wealthy people. The average income of a Sierra Club member is over $100,000. The average age of someone who supports a nature conservancy is 65 years old. These are just populations that are not like the broader public, yet they're clamoring for doing things in the public good. So I find that the modern mutual aid societies, if you want to think of them as such, are far less representative of the broader community than may have been true in those small localities. They're much more national in scope, for example.
Lane?
I think it depends entirely on what their objectives are and their methods are. One can deplore the Sierra Club and other groups that try to invoke government power and increase it or use it for their own ends. There are organizations that have the opposite objective. Think of CATO. Think of the AHI. These are organizations that are not seeking government power. There are also others that are trying to reduce government power. On some variations of the Tea Party might be regarded as that. And so it depends very much on what they're after and how they do it.
Jim.
With regard to the Nature Conservancy, that does work, does a lot of its work through markets by collecting private contributions and then purchasing land rather than persuading the legislature to purchase land.
Okay. Briefly.
This might be a too obvious point for this audience, but it always struck me that the people on the left that decry lobbying and big corporations lobbying and whoever lobbying, the reason that they're lobbyists is because the government is so big and can do so many things, right? You're going to get lobbyists if you want big government. So,
Hi, my name is Vinit. I'm from the University of Rochester. So you guys talked a lot about the merits of political and participatory action. A few of you also made the claim that this sort of participation is on the decline and that it might be
closer.
Sure, and it might be a bad thing. My question is, how much of that do you think is due to our increase in wealth? We've been able to channelize self-interest into a market function. We can substitute away from a lot of harmful government actions. We're less dependent on government than I think we used to be. It used to be the case, for example, that a government would pass a tax or something, and that could, you know, obliterate the wealth of an entire town, and that's no longer the case. So my question is it necessarily bad that we're not so engaged in our politics or our participatory mechanisms today? That's a function of our increase in material wealth. Has our increase in material wealth created a sort of autonomy from the state? And so is production and the market function a kind of make weight?
I would say, I don't know. I would probably challenge the premise of your question. I think that more people are getting stuff from the government today than have in the past. The numbers may actually be in the better than 50%. I mean, I don't know. I'd love to see numbers on this, but when you combine everything from student aid to unemployment benefits to good Lord knows what. I mean, it's everywhere. I find it very hard to believe that the numbers of people who are gaining something from the federal government are actually declining. I think that they're advancing. Go ahead, Pamela.
I just wanted to speak to another aspect of your question because I thought you were raising the issue of apathy and our indifference to what is going on in the public sphere, like Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone and the decline of many kinds of associations. And I mean, at our school, for example, the students speak of something called slacktivism, which I think paying your dues to the Sierra Club showing how you feel with respect to the Japanese tsunami. This was brought up because of the Kony 2012 video, which produced a tremendous amount of righteous indignation, but very little action. And you connect this to the possibility of material wealth or material acquisitiveness, and so on. And I think that is an interesting question to pursue. I mean, what happens to our moral character, and do we try to satisfy our responsibilities toward others in the easiest possible way?
Tiffany, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I guess we've been talking a lot about the different forms these private associations can take, and while there's no necessity that they function as a curb on government in some respects, if they've been surrounded by, if they're centered around certain beliefs, they can. But I also think it's important to note that that we've been talking about, we've made mention of private voluntary associations, businesses, the church, family. I don't think it's the case from the standpoint of kind of a classical liberal theory that all of these organizations are of equal importance in terms of forming a certain character, and that the disintegration of some of these associations is of far greater weight than others. First and foremost, the family. So if you look at Locke's thought, the family not only has a central role in terms of, Locke privatizes education, really. The state is not responsible for educating its citizens to virtue. That is going to be done in the private sphere, primarily by the family and the churches. And so in Locke's presentation of it, the family has to take a certain form if it's going to be able to tie parents to children, tie their resources, and hopefully instill certain behaviors in their children. The loss of the family's inability to do that is of far greater consequence for the overall success of the project than is the Sierra Club.
I'm going to break my own rule by making one more comment about this because I think it's interesting. It almost seems to me that the acceleration of government input in so many areas of society that have these moral components, the social justice type stuff, anything from unemployment insurance to environmental concerns or whatever, coupled with what Hayek was talking about in the last session, it almost seems that, and what we're talking about establishment, it almost seems like this has become the national church, right? That all of those things that were supposed to be taken care of by church organizations now seem to be taken care of by the government. And while we do have the disestablishment clause, the establishment clause in the First Amendment, it almost seems as if it's been replaced by this it's a non-metaphysical church, but nonetheless, most of the goals are being accomplished by the government. And it's a really, really wild thing. It's enormously expansive. Yeah, go ahead.
Just a quick response. This was something that Hegel foresaw, actually, as being a very advanced stage of history. In other words, when freedom becomes the conscious aim of the state, he suggests the separation of church and state is in the essential respect overcome, because the idea is freedom is man's spiritual welfare. And so this was the understanding of salvation that was left in kind of the Lutheran church. And when the state takes that as its proper aim, the separation of church and state is, in this critical sense, overcome. They have the same object. Yeah. And the progressives pick up on that, yeah. So that the state does. It's not the separation of state, church and state is overcome, not in the sense in which the state becomes the agent of salvation in a traditional sense, but in the new sense that the progressives articulate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Hi. My name is Jamie Lee, Hamilton College. I have with me here, good scholar that I am, a book that I'm reading for class. It's Hacker and Pearson's Winner Take All Politics. And he discusses the disproportionate wealth increase of the 1% in comparison to the rest of the country. And I haven't finished reading it yet, so forgive me if this is premature. But I believe he attributes this to the lack of representation on part of the non-1%, as the majority of people representing the country are not... or they're cultural and economic or social elites of some kind. So I suppose my question is, isn't it possible that the federal government, the increase in size is necessary because they serve, it serves as a kind of buffer between the super elite and the regular person.
Okay, how many people want that one? Bob, because you haven't heard from him.
I will begin with another observation about de Tocqueville, which is that de Tocqueville warned not only of big government, but also of big business. And that is to say, he was concerned about the citizen being lost in anything that might kind of overwhelm him. So he warned both about soft despotism, but he also warned about the aristocracy of manufacturers. So if we're just... And therefore, yes, I mean, you know, some kind of, you know, balancing act always has to occur in society. And if you think that at certain points, you know, that inequality becomes too extreme, then, you know, even on Tocquevillian grounds, there would be some justification for being concerned about that sort of thing. The question is whether or not, you know, with regard to the poor, whether or not, you know, all of the programs that, I mean, this is sort of came up in Roger Kimball's speech, you know, as to whether or not they're increasing the cycle of dependency and therefore removing the possibility of being full-fledged citizens or if it's actually empowering them. That's a long and complicated debate about the effects of the Great Society, you know, everything from the Great Society up to present day. But I think just on Tocquevillian grounds, I mean, Tocqueville does have many sides to him. He has a left-wing side and a right-wing side. So if we're just using him as the example, it's possible that he could give something that would be sympathetic to what you're saying.
Jen, and then Jim. Jen first. Jennifer.
I am first?
No, Jennifer. I shall refer to you as James from here on.
So I think that it's actually... ostensibly a completely legitimate point to pose government as the make-weight to the resources commanded by some sort of business power, right? Until you get to the next stage where you realize that those resources that give businesses or large corporations any kind of power can also be used to turn the government power in their favor as well. So it's not necessarily that the aim was not correct in thinking of that as a counterbalance, in thinking of government as a counterbalance to business, but it's simply just an ineffectual tool because the government will be completely captured by the business's resources, which really leaves us to the point where we're thinking it's almost a race to the bottom. So are we better off giving the government the power to constrain business, or are we just better off having no power at all, given the fact that the business will capture that power?
Yeah, go ahead, Jeb.
I'd like to make three points. First, I'm struck by that title, Winner Take All. I think it's a very clever title. It's also a very dangerous title. It is clearly possible for there to be an increase in the gap between the so-called rich and the so-called poor, even though both ends of that spectrum get richer. If you have $10,000 and I have $100,000, and then you increase your wealth from $10,000 to $30,000, and I increase my wealth from $100,000 to $150,000, we're both getting richer. The gap between us has become larger. You're getting richer faster than I'm getting richer. But the fact that the so-called rich-poor gap is widening does not mean that the poor are getting poorer. This business of the rich get richer and the poor get poorer is not necessarily true. Second, if you're concerned about corporations getting wealthier, why don't you buy some stock in them? And it is now very, very easy to purchase stock. Transaction costs, commissions are way, way, way down, especially through mutual funds and in particularly through index funds. I'm not selling index funds. Third, we talk about the bigness of corporations, but that bigness does not save them. Look at Eastman Kodak. Look at Polaroid. Look at IBM 20 years ago or so. When they passed by the opportunity to pursue the personal computer and stuck with the mainframes, they took a huge hit on that.
Charlie, did you have something quick to say?
Yeah, just one quick comment. The way you phrased your question, I think the answer to it might be yes, because you mentioned the idea of government acting as a sort of a buffer between maybe the 1% and the 99%, in the sense that it, you know, keeps people within the 99% or the 1%. Yeah, I think that's true, because you know, people typically move from one group to the other over the course of their lives. That happens all the time. Government has a tendency to protect incumbency. So if you're an entrepreneur and you want to start a business, it's the incentive of well-established business to stop you from doing that, because competition is difficult. It's a tough way to make a living. They're better off using the function of government to keep you from doing that.
I guess Tocqueville defined a voluntary association as a matter of citizens gathering. And in this past year, we've seen a new form of gathering, which is Occupy Wall Street, Occupy San Francisco, Occupy whatever. How does this fit into the framework that de Tocqueville established?
Great question.
Elaine, if you want to answer, go ahead.
It's an example of a voluntary association of the wrong sort, trying to invoke government power to destroy other people's liberties. And I think it's also an expression of the failure to recognize that what is wrong when people object to inequality, what's really operative there typically is envy. Unless you are dealing with envy, it's not at all clear that there's anything wrong at all with inequality. And that's a problem which doesn't really get addressed, because there's the underlying assumption, I think, in response to the previous question as well, that, and a failure utterly to understand, that the market is always a positive-sum game. Gains that are obtained through the market are not gains obtained at the expense of any of the other participants, but rather they are obtained simply because voluntary transactions have been entered into by all parts. People normally will not enter into an exchange unless they expect to get something better from the exchange than what they offer up for the exchange. And so one can count on a conceptual benefit there from operating through markets, which are not zero-sum games. They're positive-sum games, and they're certainly not negative-sum games, which is what governments always are.
Okay, Charlie, did you have one more comment?
Just one quick point about the terms of the association that created the Occupy movement. Kyle made a great point earlier about outrage and abstraction not necessarily being like an appropriate rallying point for a movement. I have no idea what Occupy thinks necessarily, but I know that they're very angry.
Okay.
So this is a question building off something Professor Honeycutt said earlier. And so my question is with regards to individualism, and this is directed more towards the libertarians and anarcho-capitalists up there, is it possible that an extreme form of individualism starts sapping the social forms which help coordinate people, and that actually extreme forms of libertarianism which have an ethos of abstraction actually further the growth of the government?
Yeah, I don't know if I would be considered a libertarian or what. As my teacher always says, I'm not on the right or the left. I don't want to be in the building. Right? So I don't. I'll let other people speak, maybe to defend libertarianism against this claim. I mean, I think it's possible. It's possible. I think Flagg was alluding to this. When you're only worried about negative liberty, when you're only worried about, Oakeshott talks about this when he says what Hobbes is likened in his account is this kind of magnanimous man without pride. This character that Montaigne is talking about, that you need, liberal society needs something else beyond just self-interested people, right, that are only worried about themselves individually. I think Tocqueville's worried about this, Mill's worried about this. This relates to the point of envy, I think, right? Nietzsche's wrong about a lot of things, but I think he's right that most people are resentful, and it drives most of their action, right? And I think when you absent something more than just an abstract sense of the individual, you're led very quickly into things like envy and resentment. Without any type of, there's no sense of nobility necessarily in self-interest, right? So,
Jennifer, did you want to answer?
Yes.
Jennifer, not James, Jennifer.
James
it is.
I think that so long as government is perceived to be able to do things more efficiently than individuals can do them, correctly perceived, then unrestricted libertarianism will not lead to the demise of government. Is that what your question is?
Go ahead, Tiffany.
That was precisely Tocqueville's argument. I mean, his fear that democracy would go in two directions, toward a kind of atomized individualism in which people had no connection, and toward the all-powerful state at the same time. And I think there's some truth to that, yes. I mean, that's why I'm not a libertarian. I mean, I think libertarianism is a partial truth which is turned into a total truth. And it's like takes a good idea, you know, and takes it too far. And part of the breakdown of the family in this country is simply social mobility. And we were talking about this last night. I mean, you know, your kids, you're raised in New York, and some of your kids wind up in Portland, Oregon, and some in Texas. And if you're lucky, one will still be in New York, as I like to say, within 3 hours so I can see my grandchildren. I mean, that's just social mobility and upward mobility, and that's a negative consequence of kind of the individualism of a competitive marketplace. So, yeah, I agree with that, and I, as Tocqueville, would agree with that, too.
All right, I'm going to go. I'm just going to say it.
I was going to say.
So I'm a libertarian, you guys might be confused at this point, given my various comments.
She's out of the closet.
Just to be clear. I'm a libertarian, and I'm proud of it. And no, I think it's I say this because, actually, given all of my previous comments and the fact that I'm a libertarian, there's no inconsistency here. And I think that people have some sort of almost bizarre view of what libertarianism is. It simply means having negative liberties protected by the government, and that being the only thing that the government should do. So it doesn't. Libertarianism and individualism and some sort of egoism or atomism are not at all synonymous. And I think that when you try to make it that way, then you're really just trying to make your argument easier for yourself in order to try and dismiss libertarianism as anything that you should think about. So, you know, libertarians are extremely interested in association and understanding how it is that individuals cooperate voluntarily. Right. And this is, you know, Eleanor Ostrom won the Nobel Prize, every libertarian stood up and cheered. And it wasn't because she said individuals act separately. Right. It's because she said voluntary associations of individual people acting together in a collective can solve collective action problems that the economic theory says can't be solved. Right. Libertarians were excited because there was a person out there showing that individuals can act together even when the government is not forcing them to. All right, so libertarians are quite pleased to live in communities and to be socially conscious. There's no connection at all between this atomism that you're thinking of and libertarianism.
No. Okay. That's it. We're over, so they're going to start taking lunch away if we don't go and eat pretty soon. Now, two things. If you're interested in hearing the talk on entrepreneurship, it's going to be in the room next door to this one, and lunch will be served there as well. And otherwise, lunch is out there in the atrium. We'll see you guys this afternoon for the Obamacare panel.